You're listening to a program from the Aloud Archives. Aloud is a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the LA Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud.
Erica Clark, I'm co-curator of Racing Toward the Millennium. I'm with the Museum of Contemporary Art, and along with Louise Steinman of the Central Library, who is my co-curator of the series, we're delighted to welcome you here today to the museum and to the first event in the new season of our series, which is now in its third year. And I thought, what a perfect thing, as I got up today in the middle of this spring day in winter, to start the series with an author who is really talking more than anything, I think, about, oh, the cycle of renewal in our lives. It just seemed apropos. I can also say that this is the first time, to my knowledge, in 10 years at MoCA, that we've had a tree on stage at the museum. So without further ado, enjoy the reading, and I'd like to present Dean Wiley, who will moderate the reading today. Thank you.
Thank you. 10 years ago, the Times op-ed page received an article from a man with a peach problem. And the editors admired the writer's ability to paint a vivid picture of his efforts to find buyers for a variety of fruit that, despite its superlative taste, was no longer favored by produce buyers because it didn't have the shelf life of newer varieties. Well, we accepted the article with enthusiasm and gave it a headline, Epitaph for a Peach and for the Sweetness of Summer. So I'm pleased that Mas Masamoto's Suncrest Saga had its origins at least in part on our pages, although I can't claim credit for the headline, later adopted by HarperCollins for Mas's delightful book. It was also about 10 years ago I found while plumbing the Times database the other day, that the paper had a visit from the eminent writer and naturalist Wes Jackson. I'd had a chance to visit his land institute in Salina, Kansas, and observe his efforts to preserve and restore a portion of the Great American Prairie, and to hear his thoughts on how we relate to the land. Jackson addressed a breakfast meeting of Times editors, and that morning I drove him from his hotel to the paper, accompanied by my then teenage daughter. Wes, in the course of our trip to the Times, asked Victoria about her career plans. And learning that she was uncertain of her goals, he asked her if she'd ever considered taking up farming. Well, it was perhaps the only time I've ever seen my thoroughly urban child at a complete loss for words. It was as if he'd asked her if she'd ever considered taking up acrobatics on the high wire. So far was farming from her normal frames of reference. And that made me realize how far most of us city folks are from the sources of our sustenance and from the kinds of lives lived by people like Mas Masamoto and the legions ever shrinking of family farmers like him. In a way, farming is a high wire act with the farmer constantly matching wits against Mother Nature and hoping that if he fails, there'll be some sort of safety net there to let him survive and start again. And often there is not. Mas has written movingly of the perennial battles fought by the family farmer, struggling against the tide of agribusiness, beset by plagues minor and major, from pesky Bermuda grass and peach tree borers to raisin spoiling rainstorms and killer hailstones. Adding to these uncertainties is the treachery of market economics. The farmer can grow a bumper crop and find that no one will buy it, or he can wind up, as Mas has noted, actually owing money to the fruit packer after the crop is sold and on its way. Wes Jackson, for his part, sees the American farmer increasingly unable to use and live with the land in the way that his forebears did. And as for the youth of today, deciding on a career in farming, Jackson observes that our universities now seem to offer only one serious major, upward mobility. I guess Moss was upward bound, trying to escape the provincialism and boredom of farm life as he saw it as a young man when he left home for college. He enrolled at UC Berkeley, went to Japan for his junior year abroad, graduated cum laude in sociology, and headed for Davis to get a master's degree in community development, studying family farms and rural ethnic communities. Somewhere in this progress, he decided to return to his roots and go to work with his father on the family farm in Fresno County, near a little community called Del Rey. One factor in the equation may have been his good fortune in meeting a wonderful woman at Davis, who also had a farm background, Marcy Thielicke, who's with us today, who became his wife. If you don't recall the passage, perhaps Moss will include the account today of the dusty moment in the fields of his farm when Marcy first met his father. Marcy has a prominent role in the book, cast as the voice of reality, as you know if you've read the book. And Marcy really is all that Moss could have asked for in a farm wife. She's vibrant, resilient, and employed. Marcy and Moss have produced two future farmers, also both with us today, in Nikiko, who's 11, and Corio, who's 5. And perhaps a potential author in his daughter, who sometimes, and maybe today, will too, join him on the lectern for peach readings. Moss has not only found time with the ups and downs of farming 80 acres of prime San Joaquin farmland to write books like Peach and his earlier Country Voices, but to serve since 1993 as a member of the California Council for the Humanities, and to play a key role in the California Clean Growers Association and its furtherance of sustainable farming. He's lectured across the country in the wake of glowing notices for Epitaph for a Peach, and last year won the Julia Child Cookbook Award for literary food writing. And now people are asking him for his recipes, of course. At one point, Epitaph for a Peach was leading the bestseller lists in the Central Valley, easily outpacing works by such literary giants as Bill Gates and Howard Stern. That gives hope. All through the gentle pages of Epitaph for a Peach, Moss grapples with the nature of his relationship to the land. I think I like best his lines in the section Autumn Work, which comes in the third section of the book. Every fall, I plant seeds of change for the next year. I am an explorer and an adventurer, a wild man in the woods. And here's Moss Masumoto to tell us more.
I bet you're surprised a little to walk in and see a peach tree greeting you. And this is a peach tree, by the way, and later on I'll discuss it a little. I want to thank you, Dean, for that marvelous introduction. Erica and Louise, thank you for the museum and the library for allowing me to share some of my stories with you today. It's funny because I consider myself a farmer first and a writer a close second. Obviously, when I'm working in the fields, I have certain joy that comes to me, but working out in the nature and working with my land. And when I'm writing too, I often smile because I think about my farming and I found a profession that actually makes less money than the art of writing. So for you artists and writers in the audience, hopefully I give you some hope from my discussion today. Today I hope to bring a taste of the farm to you through my stories and words. And the best way to start is to read about this peach that I grow. Suncrest is one of the last remaining truly juicy peaches. When you wash that treasure under a stream of cooling water, your fingertips instinctively search for that gushy side of the fruit. Your mouth waters in anticipation. You lean over the sink to make sure you don't drip on yourself. Then you sink your teeth into the flesh, and the juice trickles down your cheeks and dangles on your chin. This is a real bite, a primal act, a magical sensory celebration announcing that summer has arrived. Well, when you grow a peach like that, you develop a relationship with it. And certainly there's a passion that I had for this peach. But as Dean noted, there's two major problems the Suncrest peach has. First of all was the shelf life. It was a peach that was very popular in the 50s and 60s, but nowadays they bred new peach varieties that will last much longer in cold storage and on retailer shelves for up to six weeks at a time. That doesn't seem very natural to me. Unfortunately, a natural peach like the Suncrest doesn't fit into those current market needs of shelf life. The second problem that it has, and it's probably more of a primary problem, is when the Suncrest is ripe, it has this amber glow to it. Most peaches these days have been bred that be lipstick red, and people equate that redness with maturity, ripeness, and also good taste. So what happens with my peach is often I can't find a buyer for it. And in 1987, I had 4,023-pound boxes of my Suncrest peach in cold storage with no buyer. I talked with my fruit broker and he said, okay, I'll try to see what I could do. And he ended up finding a broker and he said, I have good news for you. I found a broker, a buyer, excuse me. And the bad news is he'll buy them for 50 cents a box. Uh-huh. The box itself costs $1. So I was tempted for a while to dump the peaches out and reuse the box. Fortunately or unfortunately, I'm a good farmer, and I couldn't see good peaches being wasted like that, and not a very, very good businessman who would have actually saved money by throwing away those peaches. So I sold them for 50 cents a box and said, this is what farming is all about. A farmer can't do much about those kind of prices, but a writer can. And as Dean alluded to, I wrote an op-ed piece for the LA Times, which was talking about the plight of my peach. And the wonderful thing is the LA Times ran the article, and they syndicated on their wire service. And the only way I knew it got syndicated because I got letters from people across the United States, a lot from Southern California, but some from other parts of the nation, from Ohio, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, all with the common theme, and that was keep this peach. The world needs good tasting peaches. Farmers aren't used to getting compliments like that. So I was moved by it. And I said to myself, I need to find a way to keep this peach. So when Marcy, my wife, got home, I said, guess what? I got all these letters and we read them together and we're overwhelmed. And suddenly the idea that we had lost $20,000 wasn't as large of a problem when we had these 20 letters in our hand. I think that's part of farm economics that plagues us. So I said that I was going to keep this peach for a little while longer, and I started talking to my family and my farm with my father and mother who live right near us, and we started talking about how, if we could find a home for this peach. And I remember talking with my dad very briefly about that, saying that, these peaches are worth a small fortune. And needless to say, I didn't tell him that we started with a large fortune. Based on that values, we decided to see what we could do. And one way I thought maybe I could find a home for this peach is to start farming it organically. Certainly in many ways, farming organically was less contradictory than conventional farming because you're working with nature. And I also hope that in the organic marketplace, I could find a home for these peaches. The wonderful thing about farming that way, though, is you begin to develop a new relationship with your land and many of the things on the land. And let me share a little bit about this new relationship. I used to have armies of weeds on my farm. They launched their annual assault with the first warm weather of spring, parachuting seeds behind enemy lines, then poking up in scattered clumps around the fields. But now I have very few weeds. I removed them in a single day using a very simple method. I didn't even break into a sweat. I simply redefined what I call the weed. A turning point came when a farmer friend started calling his weeds natural grasses. I like that term a lot. It didn't sound as evil as weeds. It had a soft, gentle tone about it. So I came to think of my weeds as part of a natural system at work on the land, part of allowing nature to take over the farm. And that was a real turning point in the transition to organic farming, to natural farming, was to allow nature to do what it does best, and that is to grow peaches and weeds at the same time. One of the interesting dynamics, though, was that it was interesting to see what happened with my neighbors. Because as my neighbors would come by, they'd see my fields, and they'd become a little concerned. In fact, one neighbor stopped my wife, Marcy, and said, "I hate to ask you this, but is moth okay?" And Marcy said, "Sure, why?" And he shook his head and he goes, "Well, I hate to say this, but your fields look as if the farmer died." Well, I took that as a compliment. Because in many ways, I did die and was reborn in this new spiritual relationship that I had with the land. And that spiritual relationship involved not only just farming and thinking about organic practices, but also the relationship with living things on the land and things that I had often overlooked. And this passage talks about some of those living things on the land. While weeding, I feel something tickle my calf. Without stopping my shovel, I brush the back of my leg, and it happens again and again. Finally, I shake my right leg, and the thing bolts upward. Immediately, I throw down my shovel and stamp my feet. The adrenaline shoots into my system, and my heart races. I initiate my lizard dance, shaking my leg, pounding my feet, patting my pants as the poor creature runs wild up my pant leg. The faster I spin and whirl, the more confused the lizard becomes, and the more frantically he scampers up and down the dark caverns of my leg. In the middle of my dance, I begin laughing, recalling the familiar feel of a lizard running up my pants, through my shirt, and down my sleeves. My body dances uncontrollably to the feel of its tiny feet and little claws grabbing my skin. I try to slow down, knowing the lizard will too if we both relax. But as the creature scampers higher and higher, my imagination runs wild. Vulnerable body parts flash in my mind. If other workers were around, they would laugh, watching me tug at my belt, frantically trying to drop my pants. With luck, I won't open a crevice in my shorts, inviting the lizard into another dark hiding place. Instead, he'll be attracted to daylight, leap out of my crotch, and tumble to the ground, dazed for a moment before scampering into the safety of weeds and undergrowth. I enjoy the return of lizards to my farm. They were plentiful in my youth, soaking up the rays of sun, eating bugs and insects, living happily in the patches of grasses and weeds. Then we dissed and plowed their homes and sprayed to kill most of their food, and the lizards left. I didn't plan on raising lizards, but they're part of a natural farm landscape. Besides, their presence reminds me of my childhood. I can't return to those days, but I can try and foster new life on the farm, along with laughter and the lizard dance. How many of you are gardeners in this audience? I'm just curious about that. Oh, wonderful. Then you will understand some of the flavors that I talk about in here, especially when it comes to the flavors of soil types. Because those of you who have gardened either in this area or in other parts of the United States knows that different soils taste differently. This passage talks about the different flavors of farmer and gardeners have, and again, that relationship we begin to develop between the land and the living things on the land. All good farmers become connoisseurs of dirt and dust. Farm dust varies with soil types and regional cuisines. I don't know how the Georgia red clay tastes, but I have visited Wisconsin's Dairylands and Washington's Skagit Valley. Mixed with rains and lush growth, their dust is heavy and thick and has a richness like a fattening dessert of chocolate. My dust is a fine powder. The soil is a sandy loam, which would be a chef's delight. Add water and the earth and create a rich row, thick but pliable. Stir, and the air will be filled with the rich aroma of turned earth. Beat the ground with a disc, and the topsoil stands like sifted flour awaiting flavoring. I lick my lips often when working in the dust. It has a delicate flavor, quiet, yet seasoned with a certain tanginess. Growing juicy peaches and grapes amid these conditions seems like a contradiction, yet the dust tempers the character of my fruits. My Suncrest peaches are sweet, but not like candy. My grapes have a delicate taste, light, almost surprising. They both perform well in my soils. My land is balanced, and her dust complements my labor the way a dry, subtle wine adds to a meal. So that's part of that. I hope you're licking your lips right now, too. In order to give that feel of the farm to you today, I did literally bring a peach tree with me. And this is a Suncrest peach tree. It's about a year, year and a half old. And I brought it because I wanted to give you a little pruning lesson. And I'm sure you all came to the museum to get a pruning lesson, right? Pruning is a real fun aspect of the year. Because when you prune, you're dealing with generations, at least in terms of a tree. Because when I look at this tree, even though it's a young tree, I could look at the generation of this tree before today. It's sort of like thinking of a tree in terms of yesterday. In terms of looking at it, you could see a strong growth through on this side of the tree. This was probably the southern exposure of the tree, so it grew more this way. This northern growth didn't get enough sunlight, so it died out. But when I look at this, I also see, and this is the secret of pruning, I see tomorrow in this tree, in both a literal and figurative way. Because when you prune, you have to look at a tree and start thinking of a shape. Peach trees are shaped in sort of a vase shape. In fact, once I was giving a talk at a farming conference about shapes of a tree, and someone said, well, are you sure it's a vase shape? You know, doesn't it look more like a wine glass? And I thought, yeah, you know. In fact, the mistake most people do is they maybe try to prune a tree either like a champagne glass that's too tight, or they use something like a large goblet that's too wide. And the reason why there's a problem with the wide goblet is you open the tree up too much and these branches will get sunburned. But if it's too tight, you're not allowing sunlight into the center of a tree. So I concluded it helps to know your alcohol beverages when you prune. The key, though, is again, when you prune, you're seeing tomorrow in this tree. When I would prune this tree, and if this was the southern exposure, I would purposely want to guide growth into this northern side to fill this gap. I would be able to visualize this shoot becoming a main branch. And again, not let this one dominate, so I'll tip it to sort of invigorate growth in different areas. Again, the idea is trying to see that shape in a tree. So that's your 5-minute pruning lesson at the museum here. Let me read a passage that talks about this art of pruning and the lessons that you have in seeing tomorrow. All good pruners have their favorite old shears with wooden handles worn smooth and oiled naturally by working hands year after year. Armed with such a simple tool, each winter I contribute to the shape and the future of my trees and vines. My best pruning effort seeks order out of the rank growth while acknowledging the seemingly disorder nature has left me. Each tree will have branches I don't like. Some are too horizontal and flat, with flat surfaces, begging to be burned in the summer heat. Others may fork too close to a neighbor branch and will compete for sunlight. A few thick and vigorous shoots push straight upward from the main trunk, and I'll have to trust the weight of the fruit to gently pull them outward in a graceful, natural bowl shape. A good pruning job forces me to acknowledge and live with the wild. The art of pruning involves seeing the future. And it's something that's very different, I think, when you look at pruning in that perspective. Because as a farmer, you're seeing this tree 5, 10, maybe even 15 years from now. Seeing nature is one of the key things that occurred in my transition, again, to working with nature and farming organically. This is a bell. It's a Japanese bell called a furin. It has a very nice, delicate sound to it. This is a passage that talks about this bell that I have hanging on our farmhouse porch, and it rings in an ever so gentle way. A small furin hangs on our farmhouse porch. Its miniature bell delicately jingles in the slightest breeze. A long strip of paper captures the air currents and translates the movement into sound. My daughter Nikiko likes the fragile sounds. The metal chime rings like a whisper, the voice tiny like a child's. A furin reminds grown-ups what children already sense. Nikki says she hears the wind singing. I'm trying to listen to my farm. Before, I had no reason to hear the sounds of nature. The sole strategy of conventional farming seems to be dominance. Now, with each passing week, I venture into the fields full of life and change, clinging to a belief in my work and a hope that it's working. The ringing of the furin helps me understand as it flutters in the breeze. For the first time in my life, I can see the wind. And that's part of natural farming, part of saving this peach, was this idea that you begin to see different things and can see things like the wind and begin to understand that relationship that develops with that. I wonder if you could help me with this. I'd like to try to honor some of you in the audience. Who in the audience has either ever grew up on a farm, lived on a farm, worked on a farm, or even have close family that farms? Can you raise your hands? Oh, wonderful. Keep your hands up, okay? Because I have a treat for you. My wife and daughter and son are gonna give you something, because those of you with your hands up, keep your hands up. In fact, why don't you stand if you can? That'll even make it better, okay? You probably have never in your life been honored to have these farming connections. Well, to this afternoon, I'm going to honor you with a little bit of the Masumoto Suncrest Peach Jam. This is a jam that my wife and I, along with some friends, help, and we put up this jam so we can give it to people so they can get a taste of our farm. And I also like to honor you people for claiming, at least publicly claiming, this relationship that you have with farming. Because as you know, farmers have to be some of the dumbest creatures in the world. Because we leave so much to chance all the time. It's interesting because we tend to not think of this relationship, but then when I honor you, hopefully it'll be a way that you'll remember this relationship and cherish it in many ways. In fact, those of you who stood, how many of you farmed or farmed land at some time in your life? Great. How many of you farmed land for longer? I want to find out who farmed the land the longest. Okay? Who farmed for over 10 years? Raise your hands. A couple? 20 years. 20 years? One gentleman. Correct? Would you stand, sir? I want to honor you. Thank you. You should appreciate that applause, because it's probably the only applause you ever got in your life for being a farmer. Okay. And I also want to honor you with a gift. This is probably the last thing an old farmer wants, is to plant another tree. But I want to give you a Suncrest tree that I just dug out yesterday, so it should be able to, if you plant it today or tomorrow, it should take. Again, a way of taking some of the farm, my farm, with me. And also, the idea and aspect of farmer to farmer, where we realize that we've always shared with other farmers much of our lives. Because that's one of the things that keeps many of us in farming, is this relationship that we form with others, with our neighbors, and also the tie that we have through our whole lifetime of working the land. So afterwards, please claim your tree, and hopefully you'll enjoy that taste of the Suncrest peach too on that tree. I ask audience often to talk about and acknowledge some of these farm memories that we have, because I think they're a very personal memory, especially because they deal with aspects of food. And this passage will maybe help you make that connection. In trying to save my Suncrest peaches, I've discovered that they are more than just food. They are part of a permanence, a continuity with the past. People who enjoy my peaches understand what sweet, juicy ones taste like. Biting into one may send them back to the orchards of their childhood and that warm sense of family found in memories. Individuals leave for the city, but memories of farms stay behind to anchor personal family histories. My peaches find a home with these folks, a touchstone to their past. And really, that's what good food does. And that's what good peaches do. They connect you with these memories that we have, especially these childhood memories of those of you who had received the taste. Maybe it'll connect you with those kind of memories. One of the most important aspects of our farm is that it is indeed a family farm. And I want to introduce my wife, Marcy, who's an important part of the farm, and also my daughter, and my son. Can you help her? My wife is important because she is the one who supports my habit of farming and riding. And also my daughter is great because once someone asked her, what would you like to do? And she said, I'd like to be a farmer and a rider. And I said, it's amazing how naive young children can be. My daughter's voice is very much part of Epitaph for a Peach. And I thought maybe you'd like to hear that voice. So she's going to read a little section for you. Mm-hmm.
Learning to fail. I have witnessed both the successes and failures of our farm. I have touched and tasted ripening fruits and have watched the power of weather unleashed on the fields. I know my father is vulnerable to things out of his control. This becomes part of my artwork. I watch spring thunderstorms march into our valley and ravage our peaches with a downpour of hail. As the first ice balls crash down from the heavens, I see my dad outside under the darkened sky and hear him cry, "Stop!" Later, I draw a picture of the storm with a farmer wearing a big hat to protect himself. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's fun because clearly my family are part of Epitaph for the Peach, and the lessons that my wife, my son, and my daughter teach me are invaluable. Farming has been part of me ever since I was born because I grew up on a farm. And this section that I want to read to you captures some of those memories of family and how they're intertwined with a special place. Because when you're born on a farm and raised on it, that place is part of those childhood memories. My brother and I sometimes camped out in our fields. During a break between the summer fruits and the family packing shed work, we pitch a homemade tent made from an old bedsheet and tree rope. You would think working all summer with these peaches and grapes, we'd be weary of them. But we wanted to sleep in the wilderness and drew no lines between our fields of play and our fields of work. This wasn't just a farm, it was our home. Just before we fell asleep, I would hear Dad open the door, back door. I think he purposely let the door slam shut so that we'd know of his presence. He'd stand listening to the sound of his fields with his sons sleeping out in the darkness. I knew he could smell us. In the windless summer nights, the smoke from our campfire would drift toward the house, a beacon revealing our location. After a few minutes, I would hear the door slam shut again. He'd go to bed knowing all was well. Those are some of the family memories that you have when you grow up at a place. It's that sense of place that combines with that sense of history. And it's what all farmers have in their physical relationship with the land. And in fact, it's a physical relationship that goes to some extremes at times. And this one next section will describe that, and it's entitled Farm Junk Piles. Most family farms have their own junk pile. Tucked behind a barn or back near an outbuilding sits a gathering of old tools, machine parts, and remnants of discarded equipment. These piles tell a story of memories and histories of who you are and where you've been. This collection links generations of farmers to a shared piece of land. The story of the farmer who worked the land before us is folded on the bottom in stuff I can't identify. I have no idea how many of the objects were actually used or what kind of machinery they came from. My dad's history is buried in the center of the junk pile. He has a mental image of how it looked during his reign on the farm. When we need a particular spring or metal shank, he often recalls seeing something and heads out toward the pile. My lair is on top and includes bent metal grape stakes. The stakes will date my farming as an era when metal replaced wood for grape trellises. I also add a pallet of odd machine parts from a good friend who no longer farms. His legacy joins my pile, our friendship renewed whenever his junk fits my needs. A farmer's roots are exposed in his junk. The pile contributes to a sense of place about a farm that includes the people who were born there, grew up there, and worked there. Over the years, I too have left my mark. As the pile swells, it records the time I farmed and lived on this piece of earth. I have a feeling that maybe some of you who don't have farms also have your junk piles too, though. So. Now you could actually be proud of them. We cannot farm without human ties. Often that relationship that we have with other people gets hidden and buried in our produce. I always thought there's these thousands of invisible faces behind all the produce and all the food that you'll find in stores. It's that human factor that often gets ignored and left out of our relationship with food, and it's tragic in many ways. It's farmers and also farm workers who are behind those peaches that you see in the store. This section talks about that human factor and those invisible faces. A handful of lottery tickets scatter in the wind and drift into my peach orchard. I count over 30 of them, equating more than a half day's wages for one man. 4 hours of a man's labor and sweat wasted and lost in a summer breeze. I ask the next day about the tickets. A few of the workers smile and one razzes another. None of them has ever won more than $5. I ask, why do you keep playing? They play for the chance to dream. The California lottery payout nears a national record. We all feel the lotto fever, and I joke with the farm workers about it. They ask, what would I do if I won? I say, I'd quit farming and give the farm to them. And one snaps back, you can do that now without winning the lottery. Another banters with me and says, Patron would never give us his farm. I concede he's right. So, he adds, if I win the lotteria, I can buy your farm. The field roars with the work crew's laughter. I don't play the lottery and cannot share the dreams of my workers. Occasionally, when disking the peaches or grapevines, I'll find some of their losing tickets tossed amongst the leaves. The blade slices the paper and turns it into the earth, and for hours, I'll think about lotteries and hope. That, again, is part of that human factor that's behind the foods we eat. And for farmers, that human factor translates directly into neighbors, because the best and most important thing a farmer could have is to have good neighbors behind them and around them. I'm fortunate because I've inherited my neighbors, good neighbors, from my father, and my children will inherit the neighbors from me. In farming and family farms, our time spans are stretched like that. So you don't want to alienate your neighbors. This section talks about good neighbors. A friend drops by and asks why I waste so much space in the avenue separating my farm from my neighbor's. He suggests I plant closer to the property line and fit in another row of 16 trees. But I explain that an extra row might crowd my neighbor who uses large equipment. I can imagine his frustration swelling as my trees grow and expand into our shared border. Good neighbors are worth more than an extra 16 trees. There's a project that I'm working on right now, which I call the Good Neighbor Project. And it talks about good people rising to the occasion, so to speak. And it involves looking at the World War II evacuation of Japanese Americans from the West Coast. Much has been written to document this tragic part of American history. I was always curious about what happened with the property and belongings that were left behind. And in many cases, a good neighbor rose to help out one of these Japanese Americans who had to leave the area. And this section talks about that. A few lucky Japanese American farmers had good neighbors, good people who managed farms for their interned friends. There's little documentation of their acts. Usually it was an agreement sealed with a handshake between neighbors. These farmers were called Jap lovers. One good neighbor named Cam Oliver explains, "We didn't have a lease or anything. I just sent the Hiyama family a check at the end of the year. There was some back talk for a while, but what the heck, it was a decent thing to do. I was raised to treat others as I'd like to be treated. Our families were good friends. I tried to farm their place just like it was mine." I think that's an act of a good neighbor, and that's still valid today, because today we're facing numerous crises, not only with changes in governmental structure, but as these past winter storms were evident, people, when the floods came, depended on not government and not the public services, but they had to depend on their neighbors to help them out. So good neighbors are still relevant. When you farm a family land, you have generations on the land. And one of the things that I was very fortunate in having was having my grandmother live with us for many years. And to watch her as she did work on the land and also took her walks on the land. And this next section talks about having a family farm where you have generations on the land. By the way, the Japanese term for grandmother is called bachan. I remember bachan. As if walking against the wind, she would slouch forward and plod along the earthen trail. Her frail 80-year-old legs would shuffle through the soft dirt, creating puffs of dust that marked her path. She'd clasp her hands behind her, shoulders round, and droop toward the earth, her tiny frame silhouetted against a brilliant orange setting sun. I can picture her trudging through fields she worked but never owned. Yet I believe that despite a life of poverty and a crushing upheaval of World War II relocation, in her old age, she found peace during those farm walks, covering familiar territory and finding a place where she belongs. And now that I work that land, even though my grandmother passed away about 10 years ago, when I see a shadow in the field, I still like to think that's her spirit walking the land with me. I like to close with a final passage that will hopefully complete this picture of my farm that I tried to bring and share with you today. Every winter, when I walk my fields, I see a white egret on the ditch bank. I stop my work and watch her, keeping my distance and staying in my vineyard. The creature stands motionless. Each of us studies the other. Then the egret crouches, bends her legs, and launches herself upward toward the heavens. I watch her spread her wings wide and with each stroke soar higher aloft, circling my farm and myself. I hope she will see the green of my winter cover crops and lush fields, that she can imagine the brilliant colors of spring wildflowers and crimson clovers. I hope she feels the abundant life in my orchards and vineyards, from the soil full of earthworms to diverse clovers, vetches, and weeds. I hope she realizes I grow grapes and peaches and a habitat for a universe of insects and small creatures. I watch the egret circle above me, hoping she'll once again come back to my fields. Thank you very much for letting me share this story.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the Estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information.